Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, tell you, I really wonder what drives somebody like Julian Assange. I really do. Now, I don't know, but I reckon this guy could tell us what drives us. Hugh McKay is the man we turn to when we want to understand our times. As Australia's leading social researcher, he's spent a lifetime listening to us talk about our hopes, our fears, our dreams. His latest book is called What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us. And since Hugh has squeezed us into a very busy tour schedule, I hope that you are going to make him most welcome. And I hope we can make this the most memorable, the most inviting, the most engaging, the most memorable event that he's done on his whole tour. So please welcome Hugh McKay. Hugh, I once heard it talked about that somebody once said that a sociologist is somebody who, when a pretty girl walks in the room, looks at everybody else. Yes. Now, I know you're not a sociologist, you're a psychologist, but in many ways that's what you do. I mean, you start these, you walk into a room and you get these little conversations going, and then you kind of ease back and then just watch what's going on, don't you?
I've spent my entire professional life listening, which is, it puts me at a social disadvantage. I've been to more than one dinner party where, I mean, the distinction between your working life and your social life is often hard to draw. Where people have said, you didn't say much. Well, that's because I was watching the people who were watching the pretty girl.
You're having the time of your life.
That's right.
So you go home from a dinner party, and I guess your wife is saying, well, you really added to the conversation tonight here. That was fantastic. And you're kind of busy scribbling notes about the human condition.
Well, yeah. I mean, people talking to each other, especially if they're quite happy for me to be there, which is what's been the case over all these years, people who volunteer to let me into their homes to talk about all these things, it's an absolute goldmine. I mean, what a tremendous insight into what drives people to just listen. I mean, they're not answering questions. They're not talking to me. They're groups of friends, neighbours, workmates, etc., who are just chatting to each other about the topic that I've given them. But to be privileged just to sit in the corner, listen to these people being themselves, just chatting as they normally would about these issues which are important to them, it is a terrific privilege, and it's been a fascinating working life, I can tell you. I can't think of a better job to have anyway, but especially in Australia over the last 40 years or so. I mean, a society that's been in a state of constant upheaval,
Right. We've
been literally reinventing ourselves as a society. I've been kind of sitting there listening to it all unfold.
Well, the new book is kind of a culmination of so many years of that listening, really. And then you've kind of collated all that down and said, well, there's kind of 10 things that drive us. We can't go through all of the 10 people can get the book to do that, but I want to just touch on a few because some of them are really interesting. I found the book very, very fascinating, as I found your last two or three books as well. The first one that you mention in the book, which you say is kind of foundational to the rest, is a desire that the sportsman, as much as the bully, as much as the graffiti artist, as much as the streaker, you say, actually have in common. That's the desire to be taken seriously.
And I should quickly say that this doesn't mean we desire people to think of us as serious. We don't say, oh, isn't Sheridan a serious person?
They never say that about me.
But all of us are driven by this need to be taken seriously, which means to be noticed, to be acknowledged as the unique individuals we know ourselves to be respected, to be listened to, perhaps even to be remembered. You know, even at the end of our lives, people are often characterised by this desire to be sure that they're going to be remembered in some way. It does seem to be a fundamental human need to be respected, to be noticed, as an individual. It's one of the reasons why we hate things like racism and sexism or prejudice of any kind that just lumps us in with a category as though, oh, well, he's gay or she's a Presbyterian or they're baby boomers. We hate these categories because, of course, that's as though to say, well, you're not serious as a person. You're only part of a group. I don't know how often I've heard young people particularly, I mean, people of all ages have this experience, but especially young people saying they're applying for a job. They send out dozens of applications, and typically they don't get any acknowledgement, even of the application.
You've been there?
And of course, you know, that happens, and how do you feel? You feel as though you don't exist. Now, that's the thing that I'm referring to with this basic need. It's why in our community, listeners are so highly prized. You know, if someone, like you're listening to me attentively at the moment, that's a gift. You know, if we listen to each other in that attentive way, it's the greatest gift we can give, because what we're saying is, I take you seriously as a person. You know, your agenda is important to me. It's why counselling works, because there you are with a counsellor.
That. No matter what the kind of breed of counselling, it's the very fact that you are actually being listened to. You are shown that you are somebody special.
Exactly. The whole counselling relationship is set up to say to the client, I'm going to take you seriously. I'm going to listen to your whole story.
What I found really interesting is that that desire to be taken seriously actually explains a whole heap of unrelated and we never would have kind of thought unrelated themes and ideas or other things that happen in our society, like celebrity and the worship of celebrity. I mean, we talk about Oprah being on the show tonight.
Speaking of truth.
Moving right along. But look at the way. I mean, somebody said that they were watching on TV and people were coming up to touch her. Yeah. Like she was kind of an icon or she was some sort of holy saint.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah. Look, it's complicated and there's never one... it's one of the things I've concluded writing this book. There's never one reason for anything. But yes, I think the cult of celebrity, which seems to be at its zenith right now, can be partly explained by the fact that when we see a celebrity, when we see a TV personality or a sporting hero or Oprah or someone, what we're seeing is someone who's getting adulation. That's being taken seriously on the big canvas, you know, the really exaggerated form of being taken seriously. And I think part of why we get sucked in to the cult of celebrity is not that we want to be like that, but we want to be the star of someone's show. And I think we like to sort of pick up hints. What do you do to attract this kind of attention? What are these people really like? It's one of the reasons why we love stories about their failures, their frailties, their foibles, because that's a bit like us. So I think this the celebrity thing is really us dreaming of being someone else's world. Someone's going to love us that much. Someone's going to take us that seriously.
There is lots.
One person will do. It doesn't have to be the universe.
Yeah,
even the dog isn't bad.
You know,
if
you
come through the back
dogs.
Door and the dog reliably wags its tail, you feel pretty good.
Yes. Hugh McKay is with us on Open House, our 2010 finale for the year. The next desire that I wanted to talk about is this desire for my place. Mm. Now, normally we would say, okay, my home. Of course, all of us have a kind of a childhood home that we particularly value. It goes beyond that, though. It doesn't have to be a home, does it?
It doesn't have to be a home. And in fact, when I've studied this over the years on a number of occasions, looking at what home means to people, I realised that home is one of those emotionally rich terms that has almost nothing to do with particular bricks and mortar, and often isn't a home itself like a house, but sometimes a place within a home. I mean, just to wind back, this desire for my place is one of these really fundamental human needs. We talk about it as though it's peculiar to Indigenous people, you know, as though Australian Aborigines, for example, or American Indians and others have this mystical sense of place, this amazing connection with the land, which is true, but it's true for all of us. We all have sacred sites. I mean, for some people, it's a favourite armchair. You know, for some people, it's the shed. For churchgoers, it's often their favourite pew.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone else sits there, you know, it feels like
watch out.
An invasion of territory. For some people, it's a sporting venue. For a lot of people, it's the childhood home. Even people in their middle years, when their elderly parents finally sell the family home, they're outraged. You know, how can they do this? Or it's demolished to make way for an apartment block or a shopping mall or something. We have this strong need for places in our lives, not just one, but places in our lives that say things about us that we're pleased to have said, that somehow symbolise who we are, our sense of identity. It's a major issue for migrants who have grown up somewhere where they've got all these magical places that are symbols of their rites of passage, yeah, you know, important phases of their lives.
Right,
all those things.
That's where I got engaged, yeah, or whatever it might be. Yeah.
And then they go to another country, and even though their kids, of course, put down their roots in the new country and have these magical places, first generation migrants, often feel as though they've lost the places they once had and haven't ever really replaced them. I was speaking to someone who'd read the book just a week or so ago. Canadian woman, married to an Australian, two Australian kids, loves where she lives, etc. But she said her heart aches every time she thinks of Canada. Mm-hmm. And she just yearns to go back. And she went back after many years, about a year ago, and it just kept weeping at all these familiar places. And she just needs to go back. You know, not permanently, but she needs to visit those places because they define her. Yes. And we all have places like that. If we don't, the tremendous sense of restlessness and anxiety that a lot of people feel is explained by not having a place to call their own.
Fascinating, that connection between identity and a sense of place. Absolutely fascinating. Another desire I found fascinating in the book also was the desire to believe in something. Mm. And you said even the most sceptical among us actually have this desire. It has to be fulfilled in some kind of way.
Yeah, I think, again, it's another one of the basic human drivers. The neuroscientists are now telling us that in terms of cognitive effort, it's much easier for us to believe than to remain sceptical. So as a species, we're a very believing kind of species. We do need this, and that's not amazing. I mean, we all know that life is a mystery, even though biologists and others will tell us about, you know, how life on Earth got here and all that sort of stuff. When it comes to our own lives, where we came from and where we're going and so on, that seems like a mystery to us. So it's not surprising we need some way of making sense of that mystery. We all need some way of making sense of it. So we need a framework, a template, a compass, a code, whatever you want to call it, but some set of beliefs that will satisfy us as explaining who we are, why we're here, how we fit in, what this is all about. Mm. And through history, of course, for most people, most of the time, that's been religion. Religion exists to provide this sense of meaning, attachment of meaning to what's going on. But if it isn't religion, it'll be something. I mean, about 35% of Australians say they believe in astrology. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Westerners in general, about a third of all Western societies.
Is that right?
And even people who say they don't believe in astrology still know their star sign, and still, when they're in the hairdresser reading a magazine that's 3 months out of date, they look at the the horoscope column, and if only they could remember what they were doing 3 months ago, they could check whether it was accurate. But we do seem to need this attachment of meaning that helps us. For some people, it's conspiracy theories or superstitions. For some people, it's not mystical at all. It's just things like, I believe in the free market, or I believe in making money, or, you know, I believe in science, or I believe in rationality. It's funny how often people talk about us as if we're rational creatures, and if only we'd behave more rationally, everything would be better. Well, I think the truth about us is we're deeply irrational creatures who are capable of occasional, very surprising little outbreaks of rational behaviour. We should be surprised when someone acts rationally, I think.
Right.
So I wouldn't be pinning my faith in rationality.
Yeah.
But we have to pin our faith in something. And the other thing about belief is that it tends to be therapeutic. When people do have something to hang on to, some kind of belief, they feel better about themselves, and belief itself can be therapeutic. And, I mean, the medical researchers constantly report on this so-called placebo effect, where they're testing a new drug, half the sample get the drug, the other half just get an inert thing like a piece of chalk, looks like a pill. Mm. And about 30% of the people who are not taking the drug experience the benefit that the drug is supposed to give because they believe they're taking the drug. And so these extraordinary stories emerge. I mean, we shouldn't be too sceptical about concepts like faith healing,
sure,
because obviously faith
there
is a healing
that's going on.
Phenomenon.
And so is it just a psychological phenomena for you? C.S. Lewis's thoughts about desire. He talked about, you know, that a desire doesn't exist unless a satisfaction for that desire exists as well. Could there be something more to it than just a psychological thing for you? I heard you once, I think I read somewhere, that you did have a faith as a teenager which you let go of. Have you replaced it with anything? Or do you think this is still just a psychological thing? Or do you think there could be an objective fulfillment to that desire that we have to believe?
Well, there are two answers, of course. There's the professional me and there's the personal me. The professional me says, look, on the evidence, it appears as though belief in almost anything is therapeutic for humans. Because of my own Christian upbringing, which, as you say, led to a long, long wilderness experience when I walked away from it, but I've come back to it as a kind of pilgrim, I suppose, as a seeker, not with any of the certainties that I once had. And I'm perfectly happy with doubt. I'm perfectly happy with uncertainty. In fact, I think anyone who talks about faith as if there's no doubt has lost their faith. I mean, the whole idea of faith is it's driven by doubt. You know, it's a leap that we make because we don't know. If we knew, we wouldn't have to believe. So I'm still in the situation of sorting all of that out at a rather late stage in the day.
Spoken to many people in that situation. Well, what I find interesting also with the desire and love, desire of love, which I'll kind of wrap up on, was the reference to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the great love passage from the Apostle Paul. I guess the Christian background still informs a lot of what you do.
Yeah, of course it does. And I think even people with no Christian belief or any religious belief at all who go to a wedding and hear that passage, 1 Corinthians 13, read, it resonates because we all recognize just in ordinary personal relationships that love is the greatest source of our emotional security. The loss of it is our greatest source of bruising and pain and disappointment. And those wonderful lines in that chapter really define for us the ultimate of what love could be, the kind of love we all want to experience. And this relates back to our very first point. I mean, that kind of love, when you receive it and when you give it, is the ultimate expression of being taken seriously or taking someone else seriously.
Good point. Always fascinating to talk to you, Hugh. I wish we had another couple of hours. We'll pick up on this, I think, next year sometime. Hugh McKay, ladies and gentlemen.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.